Thank you so much, Juliana. Hello, everyone. My name is Jocelyn, and I am a very grateful alcoholic. And I have been sober since November 15, 1980. I came in when I was 30 years old, and back then in 1980, that was young to be coming in. And I see here today so many young people. And I've spoken a lot, and that I don't say that boastfully, but I'm sitting here right now at this newcomer meeting, and I'm just moved by seeing all the newcomers that are just celebrating their day from day zero to 9 years. And I have to say that if you stick around long enough, the promises will come true. They will come true. And when I first came in here, I didn't believe that, and you may not believe that, but it's true. And all you need really is that open-mindedness, that honesty. Come in here and be honest about what got you here, and what you're willing to do. Are you willing to go to any lengths to get sobriety? And to just, open yourself up. And be humble. That was the one thing. I was a big shot, and I was the oldest of six children in my family, and I was left in charge and all that. And I grew up in a very small town in Maine, where my father was a doctor, well respected. And I've seen the beginnings of alcoholism in my family. It's generational in my family. Three generations go back. We're a bunch of drunks in our In my family, many people have died of this disease. One of them was my own father, who killed himself at the age of 48. And he wrote on the chalkboard in the kitchen all by himself, and we found him that he couldn't stand the pain. And he was so loved. He was my champion, and I couldn't believe that this happened. So I know the ravages of what this disease does. It's more than just putting the drink down. It's more than just being sociable and going to the bars or going to parties. This is a disease that will kill you. It will take you, and it will wait. When the big book says it's cunning, baffling, powerful, believe it. I've been around long enough to see the devastation. So I'm going to share a little bit of my beginnings. I had the isms way before I picked up the drink. I was raised by two alcoholic parents who were raised by alcoholic parents. So, it was just passed down. And what that is the way of thinking, the sneaking around, the lying, the presenting yourself as who you're not. And early on, I saw happy drinking in my house. There were cocktail parties, and everybody seemed to be laughing. And there was something about, I kind of figured it was in the glass that they would drink. I was probably about seven. And I thought, there's something magic in that, and my parents were just having a grand old time. And I do want to preface all of this by saying I'm not an expert on AA or alcoholism. Anything that I share with you today is really through my experience, strength, and hope. It's what I went through, where alcohol took me. The things that happened to me, the things that I didn't make me an alcoholic. The fact that I couldn't stop, it's either I ran out or I passed out. That was the only way it was going to stop. And I couldn't tell you how much I was going to have. And I was raised, in a very religious family, spiritual family. My father was going to be a priest before he left order, before being ordained and went to medical school. And so he always believed in having God as the center of your life. But it wasn't the God that I have today. So I will share that with you. I want to welcome everybody. And relapse doesn't have to be part of your story, but those of you who have come in and have admitted to having a relapse, you are here. My biggest fear is not so much that I'm going to pick up a drink, because I could very well pick it up today, tonight. I don't plan on it, but I never know where this thing is going to take me. I wake up every morning untreated because I haven't even started my day. Okay. I haven't even read my books. I haven't even had my coffee. Yes. And than talk to some people. You know, it has to be God-centered for me. And it wasn't always like that. So anyway, I always felt different. I think most of us can agree, you know, in some way or form. In my family, I was the oldest, and yet I felt like I was different than the rest of everybody. Physically, I looked different. I was told I was pretty, but I didn't believe it. I was a chubby little girl, and all my sisters and brothers were all very lean, and my mother was very lean and very put together. So I just felt like I was off to the side a little bit, you know. And I was sent away to boarding school, and I thought, why are you sending me away? What's wrong? You know, is there something wrong with me? But back then, that was considered a privilege, you know, sending your child to go to away to school. My brother went to a prep school, and that's what you did pre-college. So, but I did not see it that way. I wanted to stay home. Even though it was an alcoholic home, I still wanted to stay home. It's still something that I was familiar with. And I really didn't get my first drunk. I'll tell you, the first time I ever tasted alcohol and understood what it was going to make me feel physically was when I was about 13. And those of you who've heard my story, I'm going to tell the story about, and I hope this doesn't trigger anybody, but my grandmother liked to drink Manhattans. And when she would come and visit, she'd have that cherry. And one day I was sitting next to her and she asked me if I wanted it. And I said, sure. And I didn't know that was alcohol. I don't know what, I just knew it was an adult drink. And when I bit down on that cherry and I tasted that whiskey, it burnt all the way down. My face got all flushed. I felt, you know, invigorated. I went, ooh, you know, I kind of like that. Did not, you know, some people say I didn't like the taste of booze. I loved it. I loved it from the get-go. And the thing about this is, 2 months later, she came to visit again. This time she had two in that Manhattan. And she said, do you want your cherry? And you know what I told her? I said, leave it in there for a little bit longer so it'll soak. I knew there was something in there besides the cherry juice that I wanted. So I don't know. I think I was heading towards these rooms very early on. So anyway, that's my first time where I really felt the physical aspects. It wasn't until much later where, you know, I became discontent and irritable and fearful and different, and that's why I drank, you know. And then I drank for the effect, of course. But it was never about having one drink. I was never a sip, never a sipper. I was a chugger. I wanted to feel it quickly. Where did I learn that? I didn't really see my parents drink like that. You know, but that's what I wanted, and there was just no stopping me, and I was a blackout drinker. I mean, I you know, there were times where I came home, and I would look outside my window the next day to see if my car was still there and in one piece. You know, I really truly didn't know how I got home. So anyway, I was sent away to boarding school at the age of 13, 14. Again, I wasn't happy about it. And that's where I had my very first drunk. We were on a on a field trip, and the nuns, I was educated by nuns my whole life, first grade straight through college. So we went to an island off the coast of Maine, which is where I grew up, and some of the girls had brought some wine from home, and there was one girl decided she was going to steal beer from the marina where we came in on the ferry from mainland. And we proceeded to get drunk, all of us. And I was always a happy drunk, and I always stayed that way until the very end. And Mother Superior got wind of what was going on, and we were rightly chastised on Monday morning. And she told us, she said, you know, young girls, like young ladies, if you drink and you're with boys down the road, you're going to have sex. And that's exactly what she said. And I thought to myself, she's nuts. I'm 13 years old. I don't even think I'd been told what that was about yet. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, well, whatever. And but you know what? It ended up coming to fruition much later on in my life that all my morals, everything good that my parents had taught me, went out the window when I drank too much. And it usually, you know, being with the wrong people in the wrong places and not remembering what I did. I was told I was going to have to make two phone calls the next morning. One is, what did I do last night? And the second is, who do I have to apologize to? Because I had no idea. And I really thought I was a Miss Goody Two Shoes. I really did, you know. I went away to college. This is through high school. I didn't drink at home. I didn't sneak. I was afraid my parents were going to catch it. They were very, you know, they had their booze up over the fridge. I couldn't reach it anyway. But it wasn't until I went away to college. I went to a small Catholic women's college in Maine, and that's where everything, all the stops. That was it. I was free, you know, just smoking in the room we weren't supposed to smoke. And we used to go night skiing for our PE during the winter, and we'd pack up the woman's bus and go night skiing, and I'd have a pigskin full of cheap wine, and that's what I did. How dangerous is that? But I just thought I was invincible, you know. And of course, the boys came along too, you know, the keg parties in the frat houses, and very rarely did I go home without having been with somebody, and I never saw myself that way. And then the next day, the remorse, you know. The remorse of what did I do? My roommate could drink me under the table. She was this little skinny thing, tall and skinny, and I was, you know, a curvy girl. And she never was sick as I was. The next day, she had a little bit of headache. She'd get her Pepsi Cola, her cigarettes, go down and play cards. And I'd be sick for 2 days, you know? And I just couldn't understand. I said, boy, I'm not going to do, I can't do this again. You know, I really can't. Is this worth it for me? When I went home that first Christmas, I started to notice, that was my freshman year, I started to notice a change in my family, the feelings, my parents. Things were like, you know how you sense this not happy anymore. You know, dad is melancholy. Mom is walking around in silent scorn. So, and one night I heard my father beg my mother, will you please stop drinking with me? She said, no, you're the alcoholic, not me. And I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, what the heck is going on? So I hear the fights at night and I see the silent scorn the next day, and I'm wondering what is this? And this was alcoholism taking the over for them. And that was, yeah, I went back to college, and if I had a chance to, I didn't, you know, I really didn't buy drinks. If somebody bought it, then that's fine with me. But I was not a daily drinker. I never was. But I was, would come the weekend, starting Thursday, you know, when I got paid, then all bets were off. So anyway, sophomore year of my college, I had a boyfriend at the time, but I'd gone to a mixer. And got smashed, three sheets to the wind, and I saw a guy that I really liked, and he liked me, and we went into a car, and guess what happened? Well, it ended up being a rape because I did say no, and I gave him the wrong idea, you know, and but I, it was rape, and I ended up getting pregnant from it. And excuse that little girl, I don't want her to. I see a little girl there. I hope she's okay. is that okay? All right. And so I went back and I never told anybody that happened. I thought it was my fault. If I didn't get drunk, this wouldn't have happened. So I blamed me. You know, naturally, rape should never happen to anybody, male or female. So I went home and I went to college and I went and I told my roommate, and she just said, well, you'll be fine. Fine. Come play cards. Well, I ended up getting pregnant from that. So I ended up finally going home that summer, and I'm thinking, how am I going to tell my family? By then, that summer, Dad was very, very into the throes of alcohol, and he's begging me, can you help me? He doesn't know what's going on in my life. I can't drop this on my family. And my mother was just, I mean, everything was falling apart, and I kept silent. And then next thing I know, my father, I get a call that my father had taken his own life. And so my stuff had to be put aside now. So what am I going to do? We got to take care of this. So I ended up having, that was terrible. I mean, I don't know, you know, how my mom got through that, how we all got through it. Mom wasn't available for us because she drank through it. And I've got my secret. What am I going to do come fall? Right? And sure enough, I have to drop that on the family, say, okay. So I get sent away again, this time to a home for unwed mothers in Boston. And so I'm, mom, dad's died that summer. I'm being sent away. I've got to have this baby. Again, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. However, these are the things that happened as a result of not being able to drink responsibly, because it's that mental obsession with the physical craving. I can't stop. I never have been able to. So I have this child. I give him up for adoption. And that summer, the next summer, I'm in training in Boston, and my brother is going into pre-med. We have a younger son, a brother who's got cerebral palsy. He's going to pre-med. And I'm in training in Boston. I get a call from my mother, you got to come home. I said, well, I'm in final. She said, you got to come home. Andre was in an accident. But she didn't tell me because I had a ride from Boston to Maine. And it was a long ride, but he'd been killed that night by a drunk driver. He was 20 years old. So directly and indirectly, this disease has touched our family, has touched me, and you'll hear pretty soon what happened to me. And when I got home, it's like, and this is where I turned away from God, the God of my understanding, the punishing God that I ra was raised as a Catholic. And we had a summer home on the beach, and I just went out on the beach and screamed and yelled and blasphemed. And that was it. And from that time on, we had to have a closed casket. I drank with abandon. I added substances to that. I called my uncle, who was a doctor. I said, this is what I need. He said, what milligrams and how much do you want? Back then, you know? So during the from 1972, when Andre was killed, to 1980, to that November of 1980, I was on a tear. Now, in the meantime, when I was in Boston training, I met my husband. I was going to marry, and I ended up having a young boy with him in 1977. I ended up leaving him because it was dangerous for me to stay there. And I drank with him, but he's the first person who ever called me an alcoholic. Never heard that word before about me. Okay. I've heard it in the house, but not about me, towards me. And I was outraged. But anyway, I left him at 5 months when my son was 5 months. And so that was in 77 and 1980, the day that I decided, or I was brought to my knees. I was out drinking with my sisters. My sisters and I drank the same, and they're all either in recovery. Some of them are still active. My mother died sober with 35 years. She was 89 and she died sober.
2 minutes, Jocelyn.
Okay, I'm not even to my recovery yet. So anyway, I came in, and my mother was in the program, and she took me under her wing. And we went to a lot of meetings, a lot of conventions, a lot of 11-step retreats. And slowly, I became familiar with what do I have to do. I thought if I just stopped drinking, everything was going to turn okay, that this craziness and chaos wouldn't happen anymore. Little did I realize the work that had to come from within. It is an inside job, and the only way to do that is for me to work the steps. And I would say 35 years of sobriety now, I think I know it all, and I decided I don't need AA anymore. I've done all the steps. I've read all the books. I've gone to enough meetings. I'm busy with my mom, a lot of caretaking and all that. And for 5 years, I was so dry. And I had the worst sponsor ever, and that was me. I was sponsoring myself. Became all the bedevilments came back, irritable, discontent, fearful, all of that. And then when pandemic hit, I got nervous and I got onto a meeting on Zoom. And I haven't left. These last 6 years for me, in terms of, I hate to use the word quality of my recovery, but it's the fervency, the feeling that I have. I said today at another meeting, AA is my full-time job. I don't get paid by currency. I get paid by love. and what I'm able to give. And I hope I've reached somebody here today. Because when I came in as a newcomer, I said, there's no way I'm going to make a year, I'm going to make a week or a month. There's no way. Hey, but keep it up. Before you know it adds up. So you want to ask me questions later about more of my recovery? I'm sorry I was so much into the in drunkalog, but maybe that's what I needed to say. I mean, before I come in, I asked for God's help to give me the words. All I know is that this program has saved my emotional sobriety and my spiritual sobriety. My physical was taken care when I put the drink down, but this is a threefold disease. It's a spiritual malady that needs a spiritual solution. And that's where I'm at today. And I'm here to every time somebody asks me to speak, I hope I have something of value to share. If anybody wants my number, I'm glad to give it to you. Give me a call anytime. I'm there for whoever wants to do this thing because I wouldn't trade it for the world. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic today. So thank you. Okay. Well, I came in November 15th, 1980. My mother had been trying to find me all that weekend, and I had been beaten up by my boyfriend, so I didn't want her to see me. And it was under the influence of alcohol. I had blacked out, and so did he, and he took off. And that night, I don't know why I thought it was okay, but I went to a bar and ordered my very last drink. I looked at it on the bar and I said, this is going to be my last drink. It wasn't even like, I can't do this anymore. I wasn't crying. It was just a statement. And I don't know, I think that might have been God just putting this into my head. My mother had been trying to find me all weekend. So, I think mothers know when their kids are in trouble, but so she finally went to my sister's where I was at, and I didn't want her to see me because I was pretty badly beaten, and because I knew I was going to get a lecture. And she was in AA for a year, and she was hoping to have somebody sent to her, and little did she know she was going to get me. So my sister said, you got to go out and talk to her, Jocelyn. I said, okay. So I went out and my mom just looked at me, and this was not the first time she's seen me like this. Okay. So she just grabbed my hand and I sat down and she said, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, yes. There was no discussion. There was no what happened. There was no what did he do, blah, blah. It was really about my mom knew this was about alcoholism for me. And I said, yes. And I went to the meeting probably about 4 days later, tried to let all this kind of settle down. And I had gone to meetings with my mother before to support her back when I was drinking towards the end. And people would ask, oh, how long are you sober? And of course, we're not supposed to ask that, but they did. I said, oh, no, I'm not here for me. But when I walked in with my mom that night, and it's all the people that I had met before the last year that I'd gone with my mom, and they just looked at me. Nobody, not one of you asked me. What happened? What you did is you hugged me and said, welcome home. Because that's what we do, right? You could see what happened. It didn't matter the details or how I got to the way I was. This was alcoholism, no matter what. So I proceeded to just go, and I'm a working mother now. So I've got a my son was 3 years old when when I decided to get sober. So he was three. So he's never seen me drunk. All right. He's 48 today and he's married and I have five grandsons and I'm just so happy. And this young baby that I gave up for adoption in 1971, 2014, he found me and we got together and he had two sons and we met in South Carolina. He came down from Massachusetts because that's where he lived and that's where I had him. We drove up from Florida and we met. I was the only one sober there that whole weekend. They were drinking moonshine, but you know what? That's none of my business. And I've learned that today, so we just that came to full circle. That part of me came to full circle. I left college, that senior year, that sophomore year. I went back at the age of 50 and finished my degree. I was going to go into marine biology. Now I did it in business and I went back. And it didn't mean like I was going to get more money or a job or anything like that. It meant it's a personal goal for me because my whole life changed when that event happened to me. Everything switched, and I wanted some of that back. So I got that degree. So that was part of it too. And I couldn't have done it if I wasn't so, sober. And I went to meetings, a lot of meetings. And there was a time where I was like, oh, God, do we have to do this again? And my mother says, the door to AA work swings both ways. You can leave, but you can always come back. And boy, I didn't, and she was kind of cocky about it, it was like, and some of the people back in the 80s, they were tough. I remember talking to somebody who was at the door, the greeter, and he was a very put together man, and I'm talking, well, I think this, he looks at me, he says, you're only 30 days sober. He said, you don't have an opinion. Take the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth, shut up and go sit in the front row and listen, because that's the only way you're going to learn. I thought that was pretty rude, but I did it. Okay. I didn't start working my steps for a year. And that's just the way it was going. It was a lot of meetings. Listen to a lot of meetings. And I went to about five meetings a week and getting a babysitter. And sometimes I'd have to bring my child with me, my little boy with me. And I'd show up at the home group up in Portland, Maine. And Ken would be there and he'd be by the donuts, making sure everybody's getting their coffee. And my 3-year-old, he said, give Michael to me. He said, learn, he'll sit with me. I'll give him a donut. You go get your medicine. And that's what the rooms of AA does, The first time I saw somebody being served coffee, I saw them only give half a cup to this gentleman who had come in. And I thought, this is we're so untreated when we come in. We think we know it all. And I'm thinking, that's awful stingy. Why don't they give him a full cup of coffee? And come to find out, because he's got the DTs. That's why it's going to go all over the carpet of the bottom of the church. So when we come into into the halls of AA, we come in humble. You listen, because that's how you're going to, if you're talking, you're not learning. And I really had to learn because I have an opinion on everything. And when I started working the steps, and I did my steps 4 and 5, and I wrote them out, and it took me about 3 months to put it together. We went on a 11th step retreat. I don't know if anybody's been on those before. It's like a weekend, and it was run by the Oblates, the Jesuits. It was an Oblate house in Massachusetts, and went there, and I did my first fifth step, and I handed him the papers, and he said, what's this? I said, that's my steps. He goes, oh, no, you're reading this to me. Every single word I want to hear. It took 3 hours to go through it. Okay. But I did it. And it was exhausting, because I was unpacking everything that I'd been carrying. And I didn't get everything on my first step. Your steps are going to change as you go along. Not change, but you're going to add or you're going to forget. And do you know what I'm saying? As we become more clear, oh yeah, geez, I really need to, work on that. Looking at the character defects, I thought I was going to get rid of my character defects. That's not how it works. What do we do in step six? We become ready, right? In step seven, we humbly ask. Those two things, that's it. Pray, and that involves prayer. And just being patient, because God's timing is different than mine. I want it right now. I don't like to be uncomfortable. But I've been sober long enough, and I don't know how long it takes. For me, this was it. I don't worry anymore because fear and faith cannot coexist. They can't. Either I believe in God, my higher power, or I don't. And it says it in the big book. He either is or he isn't. We have to make that choice. When I came in, like I said, I had gone away from God when my brother was killed. So it was 2 years into my sobriety before I decided to turn my life over to, the third step, to the care of God. I love that word care. Because what do you do when you ask somebody to take care of something? Protect it. I'm giving you my will and my life. I didn't know what I was asking at the time because, again, he's got his own timing. I want it now. And things just started to get better. However, I will say that even in sobriety, life still happens. Very difficult. I lost a lot. I have been stripped of so much materially in all these years that, and I didn't handle it that well, you know, did not drink, but I didn't handle it that well. And a lot of it was wreckage from the past that I hadn't resolved, you know, and it wasn't until I was willing to take a look at that, and that was financial. You know, having to take care of stuff. Oh, I can't tell them I did that. They're going to think badly of me. You know, it's always about that pride. But what I did is I made that call, and the person that I talked to and explained to them what was going on, and I had to pay some money back. They were in shock. They were ple wonderfully in shock that this was actually good, you know, happening. So. I lost my home. I lost my car. I got very sick in 2023. I had a necrotizing cellulitis of my right leg. If anybody's had cellulitis, it's a serious thing. And mine was necrotizing. It was eating away at my leg, and I didn't know. They didn't know where I got it. And I had just retired, and I was really down in the dumps because I didn't know what my life was going to be like. I had been somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, somebody's wife, somebody's grandmother, all of that mother, you know, all of that now. And then I was a cybertechnologist. I was a supervisor. I was a manager. Now it's just me. I'm left to my own devices. And who am I? You know, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I retired. And it took me about 2 years to get through that. But during that time, I had this thing happened to my leg. My leg, I couldn't even look at it. It didn't look like a part of me. The ulcerations were phenomenal. And my wound doctor said he'd never seen a case. He didn't tell me then, but he said, never seen a case like that. And it's the first time, and I had a lot of people in AA call me, more than my family, you know, would you believe? But it's true. And, I was very, it's the first time in a long time, I think since my brother was killed, that I was in despair, total despair. I really, and I use those words, why have you forsaken me? I really felt like I was totally alone. I wasn't getting better. They were sticking needles in my arm. My veins were collapsing. And I'm sober. I'm a sober woman, but I'm going to meetings. I'm on my phone listening because I'm at a meeting when my leg is, and they're talking about amputation. And this nurse, you know, God sends angels to us. And until we go through this recovery and we firmly believe that things happen for a reason, there are no coincidences. This nurse came in and she was all geared up. She had bracelets and long fingernails and eyelashes and she's chewing gum. And, you know, I was raised by nuns. I was educated by nuns. That was a no-no. So she said, "What you doing here?" I said, "I just want to die." She, "Oh, no, we're having none of this." And she grabbed my hand and she started to pray over me. And not that my leg was healed, because it took a whole year for that to fix. But I felt myself okay. I started relaxing and letting go and said, "God, take me, whatever, not take me like I want to die, just do whatever you got to do." And since that point, I do not worry because He does take care. My program today, if you can't tell, is very spiritual. It's not religious. I don't go to church, but we have communion brought here where I live now. I live in an independent living right now. I never thought I'd be here. I went from an 1,800 square foot home to 450 square feet. I mean, that was a lot of downsizing, you know? And I thought, how am I going to live without all my stuff? I'm living the best I've ever lived with nothing, you know? And I play poker on Saturday nights with the guys. It's $4 buy-in. And it's we play for a half an hour, nickels and dimes. We have the best time, you know? And they know I'm in recovery. Say, "Jocelyn, what are you doing? What are you working? You always tell me you're on a meeting. What do you do?" I said, "Well, for God's sakes, I'm going to tell you I'm in recovery. I've been sober for 46 years." "What?" I said, "You know, and if you guys want to have a beer with us when we have pizza, it does not bother me because it has been lifted. It was lifted for me early on. And I know some people that crave alcohol, physically still crave alcohol for a year or two after. So it was a gift. Working my steps, one, two, and three, I do that every morning, just turn everything over. I still admit today, I am always going to be an alcoholic. I'm not graduating. I will die sober like my mother did. And she died peacefully. Although one time she asked me to bring her a snifter of Courvoisier, I said, "No way, you're dying sober. I'm not bringing you anything." That's the humor I think that happens when we're facing the Lord or something. I don't know. The priest had said to her, "You're going to heaven. You've already been saved." And she said, "You don't know what I've done." I mean, my mother was hysterical, a sober 89-year-old woman. And today I have a sponsor who knows that she's my sponsor. I call her at least once a week and we read from all the literature. We're reading Bill and his when the GSO First National Conferences started back in the 30s and the pictures from there. I'm so interested in the history of this program. The steps help me to get better. The traditions now. That helps me to play nice with others. That tells me that when I go to an AA business meeting, it's group conscience. You bring God in, and it's group conscience. And there's many, and I'm secretary of my home group, and I'm taking notes. And I have to be careful. I had a best friend one time. She turned off my video because my face was, I wasn't saying anything, but my face was like, they talk about restraint of pen and tongue. I need to do restraint of facial expressions because it was all over. I couldn't believe it. I can't believe they're doing this. And I'm still writing, trying to keep my head down. And you got it, rule 62, don't take yourselves too damn seriously. We gotta laugh. I didn't get sober to be miserable. I really didn't, And my son has taken me out to dinner tonight. Not that he doesn't do it, but he called me, he says, "Mom, what are you doing Thursday night?" I said, "Well," I said, "I'm going to be speaking at 4 or 5." He goes, "Okay, well, don't take off your makeup because we're picking you up at 5:30." So, I mean, and he grew up in a sober house. He saw it, he used to tell me as a teenager, "Mom, you need a meeting." He would really tell me that, He's heard my story. There was a time in my drinking, was probably the year before I sobered up. There was a gun involved, and if I'd handled that gun, or if I'd put my son to bed that night, he wouldn't be alive today because a gun went off and went through my wall in my bed and into the nursery. My mother had put him to bed that night on the other side. Don't tell me there's not a God. I mean, the bullets went right through the wall. But on the other side of the crib where my son, where I would have put him. So these things do happen. And when I remember these things, it's because I do inventories. I look back, we don't shut the door and we don't regret it, but we don't shut the door on it. And this is what happened to me. So today I have a sponsor who knows she's my sponsor. I sponsor ladies. I've got three of them. And not everybody wants what I have to offer, and I can't give what I don't have. So I have a lot of people that reach out to me. And unless you really want, I'm serious about this, go to any lengths, right? No matter what club, you hear about that. No matter what, let's show up. Let's show up and support one another. And the amends process, 8 and 9. That is the most healing part of the steps for me, and they're written in order for a reason. I was told if you have problems with step 4 and 5, go back to 3 because you haven't done that properly. You haven't really turned over your will and your life over to the care of God and go back. And that's the same thing. So when you get to steps 8 and 9, that's your amends process. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness. And how do I make amends to somebody I don't like? How do I make amends to somebody who's hurt me more than I've hurt them? I'm told I'm supposed to pray for them. The sick man's prayer. That's a big ask. That is a big ask, but I'll tell you what, I just do it. I became teachable, and I'm still learning. No, we don't graduate. This is a, I'm so happy. I really am. Things still happen in my life. I don't always get my way, but I am sober today, and I remember, what I did yesterday. And like I said, I wake up untreated every morning. And I may not have had the best sleep the night before, but I'm retired now. I can nap later. I can't watch a whole movie now all at once. I have to watch it in sections because I fall asleep. I don't know about anybody else, but I cannot see it. If it's a 2-hour movie, forget it. I'm not, I got to watch it in increments. So, I have to laugh about that stuff, and I'm there when somebody reaches out. I have a sister right now who's, she did what I did. She's not going to meetings and she's dry as a bone. And I asked her one time because she told me 6 years ago before I came back, during the pandemic, Jocelyn, you're so sick, you don't even see it. I hadn't been to a meeting in 5 years. I hadn't drank, but I was, it's as if I had. And I didn't talk to her for a year for that because that's what I did. That's in sobriety. Okay, because I wasn't working my program. You can have all the self-knowledge. It can all be up in here. But so when I came back and decided I need a meeting, and it was Zoom, and I went to this meeting, and it's my home group today, and I said, I am a hot mess. I'm 40 years sober. And the guy who was chairing had 3 months sobriety, and here's this woman coming in with 40 years sobriety. She's a hot mess. And she's going to treat herself like a newcomer. And he goes, what the heck is going on here? But he listened to me. I said, this disease will never leave me. It does not, it waits. It's still what they say, push-ups on the front lawn, right? So, and I sponsor ladies that I love dearly. And I get sad when those who don't want to do the work and they walk away and there's nothing I can do about it. And what I've learned is a position of neutrality that the book talks about. That's fine. I'm not, don't worry about it. Please don't stay away too long. And please call me still. I can be a sober sister. I don't need to sponsor you, but I'm available to you. That's not me. I use, if you do that to me, I'm usually disposing you, One thing that I, and I'll end with this. This was told to me by a sponsor maybe about 10 years ago. And this had to do with the two of my sisters, and family ties are the hardest, I think, because there's always an expectation we're supposed to love one another. Okay. But our family, our kids, my, like I told you, my brother was killed. So there's six of us left. The youngest boy is, he goes to Al-Anon because he's got to deal with the rest of us drunk sisters that he's got. He's at Al-Anon. Unbelievable. I got to get an Al-Anon meeting. You girls are driving me nuts. But there's two sisters that I have to stay out of their business because they're both active. And I love them dearly. And so this is what was told to me. A sponsor said, Jocelyn, think of you're on a stage, and this is a visual. And AA probably doesn't approve of this, but it's a visual for me. And in the front row, I have five seats. And who is sitting there? Who's close to me? Who am I putting in those seats? I'll tell you, none of my family are in there. They're all AA people, my close people who know me. I have one sister who's there, but she's back up on the balcony. The one out in California who's smoking pot and growing grapes and making wine with her husband, that's a great retirement, isn't it? But she's up on the balcony because she's untreated. And I can't be around toxic people like that. I know that's a therapy word, but it's true. Because and I have that right to do that, don't I? I only surround myself. I don't have to, somebody asked me one time, can I trust everybody in AA? I said, absolutely not. You gotta learn. You gotta go to meetings, listen to them, listen to what they're sharing. Are they authentic? Are they, do you have a sense they're telling you the truth? Oh, they go to another meeting. Geez, they're saying the same story. We're telling the truth. You're telling the truth. So I know it sounds complicated, but it really, it's a simple program for very complicated people. I can overanalyze this thing. I still do sometimes. But it's a simple program. It is so simple. Look at the way the steps are written. They're written in order. Some people go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 12. They forget all that in between. So, oh yeah, now I'm ready to sponsor. No. If you're being led by a good sponsor, they'll say, slow down. We're going to look at those character defects. And then we're going to look. I had one person say, I'm nice to everybody. I don't have any character defects. Okay. She fired me. She didn't like that. What am I going to do, you know? That's how I work my program. I don't know if that's, sometimes we have to be so serious. I don't take it that way. I mean, it's serious. This disease is serious, but my recovery, I want to pass it on. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. I say, Lord, what am I supposed to do now? I don't work. What am I supposed to? I don't have a car. That's the hardest thing of this retirement thing. I have to depend on other people. And I'm at meetings 2 or 3 days, two, three meetings a day. Or I'm meeting with someone. We read on Zoom. We have a little Zoom room. There's six of us, and we're reading Language of the Heart. That's my second favorite book. If you've ever read Language of the Heart, it's all the writings of Bill for Grapevine. Unbelievable. So that's how I run my, that's how I do my program. And it's God is centered all the time. I'm in the middle of the boat. Don't hang on the side because you're going to fall out. And I walk shoulder to shoulder with my sponsees. I am not up here just because I got a lot of years. I'm right there with you, side by side. And I don't mind sharing some of my faults with them. If I'm going through a hard time, they say, Jocelyn, you're off. What's going on? I'll share it with them. I don't tell them like the dirt. They say, the mess, give it to your sponsor. When you go to the meeting, that's you bring the message. Not the mess. Well, she said this and then he said that. No, that goes to the sponsor. When I go to a meeting, it's the message. And I can't do this alone, you know? So that's pretty much how it goes for me. And it's like that every day. So that's it for me.